Ronald Maloney, reel 4.
Right, yes, he just amazed. He'd been used to having people like Quakers and Plymouth Brethren and all the odd, without being rude, all the odd small Protestant sects. Those he could understand being pacifists, but for the state church to happen to have pacifists was beyond his comprehension. But much to my astonishment, I got what I wanted, which was unconditional exemption. And I was, in fact, the first pacifist ever at that tribunal to get unconditional exemption. So presumably I did put my case lucidly and therefore convinced the audience that I was sincere. And my objection is that this only happened because I'd taken care. I was a vocal person, used to speaking in public. I wasn't overawed and I made a good, intelligent statement. I don't really see how any tribunal can judge a person's sincerity. If I'd have my way, and we had any tribunals at all, I'd have manned by a pacifist, because I think any good pacifist would have twigged anybody who was a fraud. I very much doubt if anybody went before a tribunal who was a fraud, because there are lots of ways you could get out of the war. I mean, I could have got out of the war by being a PT instructor. I had a diploma in that. I could have got out of the war by being an officer in the OTC. If I could have squared that my conscience, that also got you out of the war. I know quite a number of teachers who suddenly discovered they were interested in running the OTC and didn't get called up. Or I could have been a translator for the Foreign Office, since I have a first class degree in French. So that there were lots of easy ways out. And so I do feel on the whole that people who went before tribunals were sincere. Lots of them were not very vocal, and those were the people who got struck on military registers, or they were tactless. I mean, they spoke the truth in an unpalatable way. It had been suggested to me by past some friends that I ought not to antagonise the tribunal, so I had changed my mind from my original idea, which was to put a totally political one and not mention my Christian faith at all. Because a curate friend of mine said, well, what's the sense of getting yourself put in prison? You won't be able to preach anymore, you won't be able to speak anymore, you're much more used to the peace movement out of prison. So I was persuaded against my youthful folly and just put forward my Christian faith very simply.
What other sorts of questions did they ask you?
It's very hard to remember now. I think they asked the sort of usual things. What would you do if you were attacked, and you know, how would you defend your mother and things like that. They're very hackneyed things. It was always somebody who was going to rape your mother or your sister or your wife, according to whether you had a mother, sister or a wife, you know. It always reminds me of Donald Soper's thing when he was asked, what will you do if a German attacked your wife? And he said, go down my knees and pray for him. And he meant it both ways. He said, you don't know my wife. And, I mean, that's really getting out of it in a sense. I have had the same question put up to me when I was debating with this admiral on Capital Radio. He said, what would you have done if I'd been present where the terrorists attacked the missionaries? And I said, well, the only thing I think I would have done was be try and put myself between them and the terrorists. One never knows what one does when the actual occasion arises. All one can theorise about these things, and one's got to be honest about this, but I don't think this has got anything to do with war. I think war is largely attacking people on a large scale and dropping bombs on guilty, innocent and the in-betweens. And so it doesn't seem to me that an individual attack has got any relevance to this. I mean, my own son has been attacked round at Kibrook Station, so I have had indignation about physical attacks. But, and they asked you questions like, sort of, how long have you been a pacifist? What sort of education have you had? They always ask all the education things early on. I think this decided how they were going to treat you. Obviously, if you fell into a certain category, you were treated differently than being a carpenter who left school at 14. And this is one of the things I objected to very, very strongly. I felt I got better treatment because I was well educated.
What was the military representative interested in?
I can't remember his questioning. All I can remember was that it was asked courteously. He wasn't aggressive, that's all. But other than that, I don't remember. I mean, I know on some tribunals the military representatives were very aggressive. So I think it did vary from place to place.
I sort of thought it would be in the army's own best interest not to have members who very strongly didn't wish to be there.
Yes, but you see, they were putting them into the RAMC. If they put you in the RAMC, you didn't carry arms except under emergencies. You could be told to under emergencies and then shot if you didn't. This freed all the normal RAMC men who were willing to fight, so they increased their war power by this. Also, when they put you on the land, they displaced some agricultural worker who would then be called up for the army. So, in fact, it was very, very helpful to have you take the place of other people who perhaps would be better fighters. I think it's rather different in peacetime conscription, where I gather professional soldiers don't like anybody who's at all rebellious or intelligent, you know, where it doesn't do what he's told immediately is told. They don't want barrack room lawyers, as they call it. And of course, in peacetime, they do get this because they conscript people of, you know, all sorts of intelligence, and therefore, you know, they get opposition, which is very bad for the rest, of course. When one person starts perking up, and others may do the same. But I think back in 1939, it was still the blind obedience school.
To what extent in your local PPU group or any other anti-war group did you have discussions, even lessons, about how to play the tribunal?
We did give, yes, we did do this. I can remember doing this in Eastleigh. What we did was we ran our own tribunal and we asked people all the most aggressive questions we did. And this is where I learned, in fact, that pacifists asking questions are much more on the ball, as it were, than non-pacifists, because we knew all the awkward questions because we've met these down the years. I think the object of doing this was, in fact, to get people experience to meeting aggressive questioning. Because I remember we had a secretary who was a girlfriend of mine, and it was rather amazing when she took over the chairmanship of our mock tribunal. She was much more aggressive. I never thought she could be aggressive, but put into this role, she was marvellously aggressive and nasty, you know. And this was quite useful in a way, in that it did get some people used to it. But you see, this young man, who was her brother actually, he went through a mock tribunal, but when it came to the real thing, it was different altogether. I don't think it made much difference. But it was quite interesting for us, and we had groups along to listen to it, members of the groups came along. And it was interesting that you got discussions, of course, of topical questions as a result of this. But I don't think anybody tried to prepare people in the sense of telling them what to say. There was nothing like that. People weren't coached. It was just to try and get people to react to spontaneous questioning. Because most people don't face up very well to questioning. Particularly if it's aggressive, they just dry up, they're frightened. As you get, of course, in police courts too. I've seen people in peacetime courts who are quite vocal in everyday life dry up under a judge asking them questions. You know, they're intimidated. And it was intimidating in the sense that everybody was up on a bench and you were in the dock down below, you know, which is quite a psychological factor. And if you'd never been to one before, I mean, I'd never been in a police court in my life, and you know, it's quite a sort of cold atmosphere. The press were there, of course. Public didn't seem to bother. But there were always press. Local papers always reported all the cases.
With what sort of tone did they report them?
Oh, they quoted a bit from what people had said, and they quoted the questions that had been asked, particularly the ones they couldn't answer very well. But it was part of their sort of local coverage. I mean, I got a banner headline in the local Portsmouth paper because, or Eastleigh paper, I've forgotten what it was called actually, because I was the first one to get unconditional exemption. And the next morning I was confronted by some of my pupils who said, came up to this and pushed it in front of me and said, "Is this you, sir?" Because there was actually a big piece about it because of this. And I said yes, and they said, "Cool, I said it was him." And they were delighted. They weren't at all antagonistic because I had turned out a conscientious objector. It was just interesting because their English master, their cricket master, also was in the newspaper, that was all. Whereas the headmaster was very antagonistic when he learned I was a conscientious objector. He was a very curious character because he was an atheist and prided himself on being an atheist, and we were always in arguments about this. And he said, why are you a conscientious objector? And I said, because I'm a Christian. And he said, do you mean to say I'm not a Christian because I support the war? And before the term was out, of course, I was dismissed. That was, as soon as I got exemption, I got my notice to take part at the end of that term.
Was this his decision, or was it the council?
Oh, no. The Hampshire dismissed all exempted conscientious objectors. If they were put on the military register, then they remained, their job was kept open for them. But if they were registered as conscientious objectors, they automatically lost their jobs. And that happened, in fact, every authority in England except for West Sussex, and I think it's West Sussex, not East Sussex, and LCC. LCC didn't dismiss any conscience objectors, but otherwise all conscience objectors lost their jobs if they were registered as such by the tribunal.
Did you know this would happen?
Oh yes, I expected this to happen, yes. Because I knew what had happened to other people in Hampshire. So I was out of work from the end of July till next January. You couldn't get a job in any county authority, so I had to apply to private schools, which of course were very, very badly paid.
This tribunal in Southampton had presumably been giving work on the land, RAMC,
yes,
whatever, to previous conscientious objectors. How much did they try to convince you that this was more appropriate?
Oh, they said the usual things, sort of, how can you object to growing food? And just as they said, how can you object to being... I mean, they asked these normally of everybody, what's your objection to serving in the ambulance corps? Surely that's not killing anybody, that's helping somebody, it's humane. You're a Christian, surely you want to do things like this. That was the sort of usual arguments. But I did advance the answer to this, that if I did it, I was asking somebody else to do the killing for me, and I wasn't prepared to do this, and I was prepared to go to prison rather than do this. And obviously they were convinced that I was going to dig my heels in, and they would have to send me to prison if they didn't give me unconditional exemption. So,
how long did the whole thing take?
I would think somewhere about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes.
And then did you have their decision at once? Or
yes,
after?
Because I remember going out and sending a telegram to my mother, who was in Wales by then.
What yes. was her opinion about having unconditional exemption?
Oh, she was very pleased. She wasn't very pleased when I lost my job, but... Some of the tribunals didn't take more than 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, a lot depended. You see, I mean, the fact that I had about 2 pages to read out, that took up quite a while, reading out slowly as I was reading the lesson, as it were. But other people, they probably only got, you know, 5 minutes sometimes.
What did you expect to be the outcome of your hearing?
I didn't really think I was going to get unconditional exemption, no. I had more or less resigned myself to going to prison. But this was one of the things I had faced at the beginning of the war. I had said to myself that I wouldn't be trained, and that if necessary I would be shot. I had faced the possibility of death, and I felt I couldn't do it even if I was killed. I can remember writing a very, very long letter to my sister explaining my position very, very carefully, telling her all the things, all the propaganda things I thought she would be subject to during the war if I died and wouldn't be there to answer questions. And I told her all the things that you'll be told you must do, because if you don't do this, the Germans will do such and such. I don't know what happened to this, but it was a long statement, really, something like 10 pages of sort of pacifist faith, in a sense.
How realistic did you think was the possibility that you would be shot?
I didn't really know, because, I mean, I did know that in some countries people were shot. And I had read, you see, that conscientious objectors in the First World War had been sentenced to death, though in fact they were never carried out, so this was a possibility, and one never knows how people are going to behave in wartime. Some people turn cannibal, don't they, in certain circumstances, so there was no guarantee. But, if one didn't face this, then it will come on you as a surprise, and I don't like being surprised, so that I think you've got to think things out in advance, because otherwise you do know that your sincerity's got its point where you're going to give in. I don't think you can. I couldn't stand if I weren't prepared for the ultimate thing.
In a way, I think some pacifists of both wars almost welcome the ultimate, not perhaps being shot, but if you do go to prison or have some unpleasant circumstance, it certainly proves to outside people the strength of your yes. witnessing.
Yes, I think I must have been tempted by that at one time, probably when I wanted to just make a political statement. Because quite clearly I would have been sent to prison then. So obviously I must have toyed with this idea. And this is, I suppose, what Eliot calls the temptation to martyrdom, which is a very silly temptation, because you can't be a martyr if you want it. And also, though martyrs are necessary sometimes, they are useless once they're dead.
And for everyone, there's a point at which he had to draw the line. Some wouldn't go in the RAMC but would go on the land. Some held out for unconditional exemption. Some people wouldn't have anything to do with registration at all. Did you
yes.
consider that?
Yes, I had considered this. This, again, I did discuss with this friend of mine, Martin Tupper, and he thought, you know, that this was a silly thing to do. And did point out that at least I could witness to five people on the tribunal, which again I hadn't actually thought of as being the sort of people you witness to, which I suppose is important. You never know where somebody's going to be changed by it. I know Dover Wilson wasn't changed by it, but one never knows.
Well, if they gave any other unconditional exemptions, possibly they were influenced.
Yes, I don't know if they did, you see, because I moved away from, since I got sack, I moved out of that area after August, the end of August, I left the area. They gave one to a chap who had a medical certificate saying he wouldn't live more than 6 months because he'd got a bad heart condition, but I don't call that really exemption, that was merely playing with it. They obviously didn't want him dying in the army and having to pay a pension to his successors or something.
But of course, by going along with it, then you admitted somehow that these five men had the right to say whether you were sincere or not in your private
yes.
convictions.
Yes, I suppose I did, yes. I didn't myself admit they had... I didn't really think they were going to exempt me anyway, because unconditionalists weren't all that common. There was quite a big division in the peace movement about it, you know. Some people got very vocal with other people, felt they were letting down one side or the other by doing it. Just as Canon Raven didn't like those of us who went on for a year carrying on a Stop the War movement, which was we did very actively in Eastleigh. We had public meetings in the open and indoors, held a dance to raise funds, wrote letters to the paper, gave out leaflets outside a local arms factory to the arms workers, which obviously was seditious. That I thought, you know, I thought we might have got arrested over there. We kept on very good terms with the police in that we didn't either truckle to them or antagonise them. When we were holding an open air meeting, we just said we are holding an open air meeting on such and such a day at such and such a time and where it was. We didn't ask permission to hold it, but we did it as a sort of act of courtesy. And the police didn't interfere with us, actually. We had quite a good coverage in a paper called the Eastleigh Weekly News. We used to get a report in every week of the FOR meeting and the PPU meeting. And we used to get about two or three letters in, so that we used to claim that the back page was largely ours. In this sense, the local papers are much more tolerant than national papers. You would never got anything in a national paper. And this still applies with Peace Things Today. It's not as difficult to get into local things as it is into nationals, because the local people have got a small circulation, and any organisation is worth so many sales of their newspaper. But we were holding at least two meetings a week in that first year of the war, 39-40, in the PPO and FOR. And I was preaching in local Methodist churches three times a day every Sunday, and preaching Christian pacifist sermons, and being asked for more. This was a very interesting thing to me. I thought, you know, that I had a duty to do this, but I had a feeling that they would say, well, don't send him anymore.
This was in Methodist church.
Methodist churches, yes. Some of them very small congregations, you know, because they were, a lot of them were country chapels.
Did you ever actually talk with any of the, either men serving in the forces or people working on various military employment in the Southampton area?
I did talk to people who were employed. Soldiers, no. The only experience I had with soldiers was one I had in a Methodist church in Eastleigh, who, when I was preaching Christian pacifists, shook his head vigorously from the back pew, and I retorted, I don't think anybody saw him except me, and I said, all the shaking of the head in the world won't alter the words and the teaching of Jesus Christ. And about a year later, when he'd been conscripted and had been fighting in France, he came up and stopped me in the street, and I didn't know him till he spoke, and he said, you were quite right what you said in your sermon, I found out now I'm in the army. But alas, he didn't come out of the army. But that otherwise, I didn't come up against many military people at all. Eastleigh, of course, was largely an industrial town. Had a lot of military targets, and then it made things, cables and engines and things like that. It had one arms factory. It was a stupid place to evacuate a school to. We moved from Gosport to Eastleigh. Quite crazy. It was part of the business of evacuation, which was just to move people, because I had friends in the National Children's Home, and the National Children's Home at Highbury was moved to Gosport, and the Children's Home at Gosport was moved into North Wales. So it was safe for the London children, it wasn't safe for the Gosport children. Quite mad. But this was part, I think, of government propaganda, you know, making people feel they were safe by being moved. And our children used to go home every Friday night, so the headmaster altered our lessons and made us have Saturday morning school, whereupon the children all went home after Saturday morning school. But they all cycled home to Gosport for the weekend and came back Monday morning. The amazing thing was none of them were killed in the whole of the war. It's extraordinary, because people were killed in Eastleigh, but they weren't.
What effect did the raids on the Southampton area have on either on the PPU membership or on people's attitude towards the PPU?
I don't know that it had much influence at all. I mean, there were two things you could do. You either went to sleep or you didn't go, or you went down in the shelter. And after about two nights being up, I told my landlady I didn't want to wake me up in raids in future. I'd stay in my bed, and that was it. And I slept through quite a number of raids. But the only experience I had of it influencing people was at tribunals, when they were bad-tempered after a raid the night before. But I didn't notice it among other people at all. And I can remember once I was out with a girl member of the FOR, and a woman came up to her and said, why isn't your husband in the army, you know? And she said, he isn't my husband. And she went off at that. She didn't ask anything else at all. It was very extraordinary. We were very amused with that. But that was the only person who ever sort of said anything. I mean, obviously, I was 23. I obviously was young. But I don't remember any other instance of that at all. I don't think on the whole soldiers were ever particularly aggressive. I heard stories of lots of conscientious objectors in chains in the First World War, you know, being taken from one place to another, being encouraged by soldiers saying to them, well, stick it out, mate, you're quite right, you know. They weren't going to do it the same themselves, but they did admire those who were going to prison for their faith.
How did you go about finding a new job?
I think I got the Times Educational Supplement and various agencies and just applied whenever there were jobs. And nobody at any ordinary school ever answered you at all.
How would they know?
Oh, because you had to put down your age, you see. And there was a thing saying whether you were exempt, and if so, what were you exempt for? This still goes on even today. I mean, right up to when I stopped applying for jobs, which was only about 5 years ago, it still said, what was your military service? So I was still up to the age of my 50s, was still writing across it, conscience objector, 1939 to 45, which was antagonising people, you see, right up into the 1970s. They were still having it out on you. And of course it affects all sorts of things, you know, your pensions affected and things like that. Not the one considers things like this, but they do. It is marked up against you for the rest of your life that you haven't served in Her Majesty's forces. And only private schools would consider you. Private schools, because they were short of staff, they paid worse salaries, apart from the very big public schools, they paid worse salaries in the state. Therefore, the only people they could possibly get were conscientious objectors or bad teachers. Quite a lot of bad teachers they got. So in the first place I went to, I was the only pacifist on the staff there, which was a church missionary school, strange enough. And the second one I went to, I was one of four conscientious objectors on the staff, getting salaries of between £2 a week and the prince's sum of £4 a week, which wasn't bad for what they were getting for it. So the private schools did quite well out of teachers who were conscientious objectors.
How did the administration at the school feel about you? Obviously they had to have you, perhaps, if no one else was available.
The church missionary school, they didn't raise any point at all, except they did demand my resignation when I spoke publicly in favour of Indian Home Rule. But apart from that, no, there were women members of the staff who were not at all friendly. Because that was the one place where I found tremendous worship of Winston Churchill by these they were all spinsters and all very devoted to Winston, and they all went to bed about 8:30 every night, probably to pray for him or something. I don't know. They were a very depressing lot, the women and that stuff. And there were only two men apart from myself. In the next place, which was Harlow College, I was there for a year. There I heard it had been given out in the village, which was a village in those days, that we were all Quakers, because it was respectable to be a Quaker conscientious objector. Everybody knew Quakers were all right. But they didn't let on that one of them was an agnostic and another one was a member of the Church of England. That would have been terrible.
And you went along with this to keep the peace?
Well, I mean, I didn't find out till afterwards. I didn't sort of go around issuing a statement, no, I'm not a Quaker. I mean, I was quite friendly with Quakers. And in fact, I stopped going to the chapel meeting of the school and went off to Quaker meeting in Epping, which was 7 miles away. Because I couldn't, this was one of the things I found difficult in wartime, I couldn't go to a church where the minister was going to support the war. So that in most areas I went to a friend's meeting. That is, if I wasn't preaching myself. But, but there was no antagonism on the staff there. They were very pleased to have us, because the school wouldn't have run without us. And then the last 2 years I went to a Quaker school. But even there they were very careful, because occasionally the members of staff gave the address and the evening meeting on Sundays, you know, like a church service, and I gave a pacifist one week, and the head of the school was so intimidated by it, didn't like it at all, he invited a local colonel to come and give the address the next Sunday, which I thought was carrying Quakerism in a very peculiar way indeed.
Well, he was trying to prove his tolerance of all points of view, I think.
He was proving he was a neutral, I think. But, it rather staggered me, that. But of course, a lot of the children there were pacifists themselves, a lot of the students. They were very... students, they were very, very good students. You know, all came intelligent homes and sensible homes, and it was marvellous teaching them. Apart from the fact they worked you to the bone. But the students themselves were the best students I think I've ever had.
During the war, what did the PPU do for the families of conscientious objectors?
I think we occasionally had sort of local collections for people when there was sort of monetary need, as far as I can remember. Quite a lot of communities were set up. I did, in fact, go one stage when I was out of work, I did go and stay for a weekend at one. I wasn't very impressed with it, because it struck me that the only people who were doing any work were the women, and the men weren't doing anything. And I thought it was rather bad for them to be out of work and being in a community where, you know, they were just not doing very much. Other communities are very good. I came across one in Birmingham, which was run by the by a church there, Worley it was, near Birmingham. It was run by the local church, and they had a curious church membership. It was a sort of independent church, and to be a member of that church you had to be a pacifist, a socialist and a teetotaler, if you please. That was really the extreme. And they ran two or three things. They ran a sort of local allotments, and they grew food, and they employed all the local conscientious objectors on this. They also employed conscientious objectors as window cleaners and other jobs for which there were no people during the wartime. So they did quite a good service to the community, and they were giving the conscientious objectors some work to do. And out of this, they financed a political party called the Christian Party, of which I became a member, which went on into... survived the war, went on into the early 1950s, when it failed for lack of money in the end, and some of their members came over into the Fellowship Party afterwards. But that was the first time I became involved in pacifism and politics. There was a very fine ex-teacher called Norman Robbins who was the leader of that. They were very, very practical, very well organised. That was how a community could be run. You know, I saw the two extremes. But, you know, there were odd communities. Eric Gill's community, you know, he ran, he was a Catholic thing. There, all the women did the work. They were sort of a slave class, and Eric Gill got on with his art. You know, he never washed up anything in his life. And this seemed to be a very curious example to set.
How did the general public's attitude towards pacifists, or towards conscientious objectors, change when it was really war instead of the hypothetical 30s?
I don't think it was very apparent, because you only experienced it in your own locality, people you actually met. I mean, there was no reports in the press. Peace news became reduced to a sort of four-page sheet, first of all printed by Eric Gill himself, first few weeks, and then it was edited by Middleton Murray, who was a very odd sort of pacifist. I never thought he was a real pacifist at all.